there's been several talks about this topic here. So it's mainly based on this paper, which I recently put on the archive, but I'll also mention some aspects of an earlier paper and some things which are going to appear in a review article, which should be on the archives shortly. Okay, so just to establish some terminology, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, an ontic state is something which is supposed to describe reality independently of observers. And the psi-ontic view is the view that quantum states are such things. On the other hand, an epistemic state is a state of knowledge or information, and so the psi-epistemic view is the idea that the quantum state is an epistemic state. So that's a lot of words which some of you will be familiar with, but for the rest of you, it might be useful to have an example of ontic and epistemic states. So if we look in the case of classical physics, just consider a single classical particle in one dimension. Its ontic state is a point in phase space, by which I mean that all of the objective properties of that system are determined by its position and momentum. So, for example, if you want to know the energy of the particle, that corresponds to a function on phase space given by the Hamiltonian. Similarly, for any other physical property of the system. So, position and momentum determine all of the properties that the system actually has, and that's its ontic state. On the other hand, an epistemic state is a probability distribution on phase space. And I've attempted to draw some contour lines here to show some kind of spread out distribution on phase space. Now, this terminology, epistemic, it's the standard terminology for this distinction, so I'm going to use it. But the important distinction that we want to make is between things which are ontic, real physical properties, and things which are kind of more probability distribution-like. And the key idea there is that probability distributions can't be regarded as intrinsic properties of single physical systems. So if you're a Bayesian about probability, you may say they represent some agent's knowledge, but even if you're a frequentist about probability, you'll say that they represent some ensemble of systems. And the point is that an individual physical system, which occupies a particular phase space point, doesn't really know what its probability distribution is. From that point of view, from the point of view of quantum theory, here are a couple of psi-epistemicists, and these two guys are obviously very famous for agreeing with each other on a lot of things. The idea of what the status of the quantum state is one of the few things that they do actually agree on, although for very different reasons. So Bohr thought the quantum state does not represent reality because he thought nothing in the quantum physical description is a direct representation of reality. So instead, it's about what we can say about reality. And I'm sure he chose this word very carefully here, but I'm going to mangle it and say, well, roughly speaking, he's saying it represents what we can know about reality. On the other hand, Einstein said that the wave function should be thought of as a property of an ensemble of systems. He's taking a more kind of frequentist view. But the point is that he doesn't think that it's an intrinsic property of an individual system. So it's something more probability distribution-like. So from the point of view of the present talk, they agree with each other. Yeah. Sure. I mean, Einstein, like most physicists at the time, wasn't very sophisticated about the foundations of probability and mixed different interpretations of it at different times. But it's fair to say that his thinking, Einstein had a background in statistical mechanics, and he's thinking of the kind of way that we think of the statistical mechanical state of a system, the probability distribution there. Okay, so moving on, here's roughly speaking, from a modern point of view, classification of different interpretations of quantum theory. We can classify them as either psi-epistemic or psi-ontic, but also as realist or anti-realist. So whether they think there should be an objective observer independent reality out there or not. And of course, all of the Copenhagen type interpretations go up here. Most of the well worked out realist interpretations include an ontic quantum state. And there's a big bit of tumbleweed up here because, of course, it doesn't make sense to be realist about the quantum state if you're anti-realist about everything. You can't say the quantum state is real if you don't think anything is. On the other hand, we have this box down here where you're psi epistemic, but you want a realist interpretation. And at the moment, this is just a list of names, really. And it's just really an excuse to put my name on the same list as Einstein. There aren't any like fully worked out interpretations of quantum theory that are of this type. And the question is, can there be, or can we constrain them? And that's where, really what we want to look at. Yeah, this is kind of like a broad, so really I prefer to call this whole section sort of neo-Copenhagen, but I'm using terminology which is more familiar here. The point is, any view in which the wave function is not part of reality, nor do they think that there needs to be any further reality underlying quantum theory, should go in this sort of category. So whether you want to call that realist or anti-realist or not depends exactly on what variety of realism you're talking about. This is just a broad categorization.
As I always chime in at this point, I think that doesn't cover all possibilities.
Yes, so I'm just trying to, on this slide, put things that are kind of easy to categorize. And the realist interpretations I have down here are kind of ones that adopt a more or less conventional ontology. So there are kind of more exotic ontologies that you could consider, and I will comment on those towards the end of the talk. And yes, things like generalized probability theories and logic and generalized logic may go into that category.
Yeah, and also things, history-based things where the wave function isn't there at all. But...
Well, I think we can discuss that that later, but yeah. Okay, so for the remainder of the talk, I want to briefly talk about some of the pre-existing arguments for epistemic quantum states, mainly to establish the basis on which these results are proved. I will mention some of the arguments for ontic quantum states, but only very disparagingly and briefly, just to show you that they exist, because we won't have time to go through them in detail. But when my review article comes out, I do criticize those in a lot of detail. Then the main thing, I'm going to introduce the framework, the ontological models framework, which is used to prove results about these types of theories. I will briefly mention some of the existing results which aim to show that the wave function must be real in this framework, point out some of the counterexamples, and then we'll finally get on to the main point of the work, which is to bound the psi epistemic explanations in terms of measures of overlap. Okay, so why should we care about the epistemic view of quantum states? Well, it can allow us to explain certain quantum phenomena that are otherwise very puzzling. So I'm just really going to give one example of that. But the key feature of epistemic states that allow them to have these explanations is that they can overlap. So here, I've compressed my phase space now down to one dimension so that I can look at two probability densities on it. And you can see that there's a region of overlap. And if the ontic state of the system is really here, then both of these densities say, well, that's a possible ontic state of the system, which has a reasonable probability and so forth. So the fact that these can overlap and the fact that the same ontic state can be deemed possible by more than one epistemic state allows us to explain a lot of phenomena. So perhaps the simplest one is the indistinguishability of quantum states. So I'm going to explain that in terms of the toy theory that Rob Speckens came up with. So for the point of view of this talk, there's a lot more structure to this toy theory, but for the point of view of this talk, I'm just going to view this as a sort of hidden variable model for a spin a half particle where you're restricted to preparing in the X, Y, and Z bases, and you're restricted to also measuring in those bases. So we have these six quantum states that we can prepare, and we're going to model them via a non-tick state space, which has four possible states, these four boxes. So if you like, you can imagine that we're simulating this system in terms of a ball that can be in one of four boxes, and that's the on-tick state of the system. And so these green boxes represent 50% probability. So when I prepare the x-up state, then there's a 50% probability that the ball will end up in this box, and a 50% probability that it'll be here, and zero probability over here. So similarly for all these other states. And the measurements just reveal coarse-grained information about that. So the x measurement, for instance, just tells me whether I'm in one of the left-hand side two boxes or the right-hand side two boxes. And it's fairly easy to see that this reproduces the quantum predictions of those sorts of experiments. But the key property that we're interested in is if I prepare one of two non-orthogonal states, then there's one of the possible states of the system that they both think is possible. So both of them assign 50% probability to being in the top right box here. Okay, so now on a psi-ontic view, the fact that two non-orthogonal states can't be distinguished with certainty is a bit strange because on a psi-ontic view, whether I prepare x up or y up, that corresponds to physically distinct arrangements of reality. There really is something out there in reality that tells me whether it was x up or y up. But on the other hand, on this sort of view, that's not the case because whichever of these two I prepare with 50% probability, I'll end up in this state. And this state is the same for both of these. So if I'm in the upper right box, then there's no way I can tell from that whether it was this state that was prepared or that state that was prepared. So regardless of which of those preparations happened, with 50% probability, I must fail to be able to distinguish the two possibilities. Okay, so this is one of the type of explanation that you can have in a psi epistemic theory. And similarly, many other phenomena, such as the no-cloning theorem, can be explained in a similar kind of way. And there's much more to the toy theory than just this, but this is the example I want to point out. There are other arguments for the epistemic view, and one of the main ones, I'm not going to talk about these other ones, but one of the main ones is the collapse of the wave function, the measurement problem, Schrödinger's cat, and things like that. The idea being that you can only get something like the measurement problem off the ground if you already assume that the quantum state is real. Right? So if you're assuming that the quantum state is real, then it has these two different modes of dynamics. Either it evolves unitarily and smoothly when you're not making a measurement, and then when you do make a measurement, it suddenly collapses and changes. And that's puzzling because what's the difference between a measurement and just any other kind of interaction? So one way of trying to get around that is to say, well, maybe the unitary dynamics holds the whole time, but then you get into absurdities like the Schrödinger's cat paradox. But on the other hand, if the wave function isn't real, then all of those states just represent states of information or knowledge about reality. So it could well be the case that when you have a superposition of a dead cat and a live cat, that the actual cat itself is happily either dead or alive, just our information about it happens to be represented by a superposition. So this kind of view sort of totally dissolves the measurement problem, and that's one of the reasons why a lot of people find it appealing. Okay, so a lot of people will come up with arguments for why the quantum state should be real. Probably the big one is interference. I just want to point out, I'm not going to go through these in a lot of detail, but at least these first two features, they're present in the Speckenstein theory. So they can't be viewed as knockdown arguments against the epistemic view. I'm not going to go into these other ones, but again, if you look at the review article when it comes out, I explain these in a lot of detail. Well, sort of, I mean, it's a very kind of vague argument the way it's normally given. Surely the quantum state must be real because it interferes with itself. So in a double slit experiment, there must be a wave that goes through both slits. Now, being a sophisticated, you can probably figure out that that's not a knockdown argument against this view. But you know, a lot of people do come up with that argument as a problem. Well, okay. So, okay, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because it'll I'll distract. But in particular, if you look at Rob's paper, there is a notion of a superposition principle in there, which and superpositions get preserved under dynamics. And you can also, by a very similar model, which Rob has actually talked about here once, reproduce a lot of the phenomena of a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, for instance. So the very fact that there's interference doesn't rule out this kind of view. Okay, so let's get to the framework we want to prove this result in. So first of all, let me talk about the type of experiment that we're going to consider, which is just a very simple kind of experiment. So we have some preparation device, and then we have some measurement device. So we're going to prepare a system in a finite dimensional Hilbert space in some pure state, and then immediately measure it in some orthonormal basis with no time evolution between the two. Okay, so we have the usual Born rule probabilities, the mod squared of the inner product there. So that's the quantum description, and that's just an operational description of these experiments. It just tells you how to assign probabilities to the measurement outcomes. We're interested in assuming that there's some real physical ontological state that exists in between preparation and measurement, and that's responsible for for how the measurement device responds to the system. this is just a sketch. I'm going to define this more formally on the next slide. So we don't want to assume determinism necessarily. So we have this ontic state of the system. This is some real physical parameter which describes the system. And we don't want to assume that the preparation device controls this precisely necessarily. Perhaps it only has imprecise control over the ontic state. So a preparation procedure is going to be associated to some probability measure. So mu of psi, each quantum state is associated to a probability measure. Then similarly, we don't want to assume that the measurement device, that the measurement outcome is uniquely determined by the ontological state, but there are various probabilities for the various outcomes. So here I've illustrated the case of a two-outcome measurement for a qubit. There are two outcomes, A and B, and these graphs represent the conditional probabilities. So this red line is the conditional probability of getting outcome A when you make measurement M. And these conditional probabilities have to sum to one everywhere because we want a well-defined conditional probability over the outcomes. So in total, the ontological model is going to say that you integrate over this probability measure of these conditional probabilities, and that should be your probability of getting the outcome A when you prepare state psi and perform measurement in the basis M. And of course, we want this to reproduce quantum theory, so these two should be equal to each other. Okay, so a bit more formally, what we want is, so our ontic states are going to be members of some measurable space. Thanks. So we have some set of ontic states, possible states of the system, possible ontic states of the system. That has to be a measurable space because we want to define probabilities on it. So there's some sigma algebra of subsets. Then each state in the d-dimensional Hilbert space is associated to a probability measure. And each orthonormal basis is associated to a set of response functions, which again, this is the conditional probability of getting outcome A in the basis measurement basis M when the ontic state is lambda, and these must sum to one everywhere. And in order to allow for Cochen-Specker contextuality, we're allowing these response functions to depend not only on the element of the basis, but also on the whole basis itself. So we want this to reproduce the quantum predictions, which just means that when we integrate these conditional probabilities over the measure associated with the state, we should get the quantum probability rule. So that's the basic framework. So now within this framework, we can define more formally what it means for a model to be psi-ontic or psi-epistemic. So first of all, I'll say that two quantum states are ontologically distinct in an ontological model if you can find a set, a measurable set, that's measure one according to one of them and measure zero according to the other one. So this corresponds to this kind of picture here, where the two probability densities don't overlap with one another. And this is the case of ontological indistinctness. You wouldn't be able to find a set that was measure one here and measure zero for this guy. More formally, what this means is that if either psi or phi is prepared and you don't know which, and then somebody comes along and tells you what the ontic state of the system is, then if this condition holds, you'll be able to tell which of the two was prepared with probability one. Because if you're in the set omega, you can say, oh, it must have been psi. And if you're not in the set omega, you say it must have been phi. So morally speaking, the ontic state of the system determines the quantum state. But really, that's a statement with probability one. So we'll say an ontological model is psi-ontic if every pair of states is ontologically distinct. Otherwise, it's psi-epistemic. And this is a very permissive notion of what it means for a model to be psi-epistemic, because it's just the negation of this. So even if you only had a tiny amount of overlap, only between two states, you'd still call a model psi-epistemic by this criterion. And because of this, you're not necessarily going to get all of the good psi-epistemic explanations of things. So we're going to want to look at stronger notions of psi-epistemicity as well. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, sorry, this is ontological indistinctness. This is ontological distinctness. Yeah. Okay, so I don't want to go into this in a lot of detail either, but just to mention that there have been recent results in the last few years aiming to show that quantum states must be ontic. So here, in my opinion, are the three best ones, which I go over in great detail in the review article. So the first one was by Pusey, Barrett, and Rudolph, and subsequently there's been a bunch of other theorems. The only point I want to make about these theorems right now is that they all employ additional assumptions beyond the basic ontological models framework. And those assumptions have been criticized, and we can debate them at great length, but it will be interesting to know whether we can prove something without making use of those additional questionable assumptions. So that's what we're going to look at now. Well, unfortunately for the Scientologists around, if you don't make such assumptions, then psi-epistemic models do exist. So the first one that was ever found is this model by Koshin and Specker, which they proposed in the same paper that they provided their famous no-go theorem in. So this was intended as a counterexample to the Koshin-Specker theorem in the case of two dimensions, but actually turns out that it's a very nice psi-epistemic theory as well. So I'm not going to go into great detail, but basically the idea is that the set of ontic states are on the surface of a unit sphere, and a quantum state, say the Z-up state, corresponds to a spread out probability density which has a cos theta density, where theta is the angle between the ontic state and the quantum state, on the northern hemisphere of the sphere in this case. So when you have some other quantum state, you just get the rotated version of this. So if you have two quantum states, these correspond to probability densities that have quite a large overlap region, and hence the model is psi-epistemic. So that's for qubits. When you go beyond qubits, so there are actually also psi-epistemic models for arbitrary finite dimensional systems. So the first people to show this was Lewis and co-authors. They provided a psi-epistemic model for all finite dimensions. And then subsequently, Aronson and co-authors, using very similar methodology, came up with a model in which every pair of non-orthogonal states corresponds to overlapping distributions. Okay, so we know that's possible. But these models all have the feature that if you fix the inner product between two states and increase the Hilbert space dimension, then the amount of overlap decreases with the Hilbert space dimension. And this is bad for psi-epistemic explanations, in particular for the psi-epistemic explanation of distinguishability, because if you think about it, if you have two states which have quite a large inner product, it's very difficult to distinguish them in quantum theory. So in order to account for that in terms of overlapping probability measures, you'd want the probability measures to have large overlap. So in some sense, you would want the overlap of the probability measures to be comparable to the inner product. So the question now is, can we make life difficult for the psi epistemic interpretation by showing that this sort of thing must happen? So in order to do that, we need some quantitative measures of overlap. So I'm going to mention two classes of measures which are closely related. So the first I'm going to call the classical asymmetric overlap. So the idea is here that for two states psi and phi, I look at all of the sets that are measure one according to mu phi and look how much probability mu psi assigns to them. So roughly speaking, the cartoon of that looks like this. So you're looking for how much of the probability distribution mu psi is accounted for by the overlap region. Okay. So then there's this definition of a maximally psi epistemic model, which is due to Owen Moroney, which says that this asymmetric overlap should give rise to the quantum probability. So basically what this is saying is that the quantum probability of obtaining the outcome phi when you measure a state prepared in the system, measure a system prepared in the state psi, should be entirely accounted for by the overlap region. So that's a very strong notion of what it might mean to be psi epistemic. But in general, what we want to do is compare this quantity to this quantity to try and show, does this have to be much smaller than this, for example.
Zero or not zero, so even if that curve had a very tiny tail.
No, this is quantitative, right? So this is the amount of probability. So basically, amount of probability in the overlap region. Yeah, so it's roughly speaking, if these things were well represented by probability densities, which they aren't necessarily, I'm not necessarily assuming that they are, then roughly speaking, it would be this area under the graph that I've indicated here.
I'm not sure I understand. I mean, suppose these were Gaussian or something.
Yeah.
Then would the overlap region be the whole line, or what was it? What, how would you define the overlap region?
Yeah, in the case of a Gaussian, let's see. Yes, it would be in that case.
And even though naively, they're just a tiny overlap.
Yes, but I'm going to get onto that in a second. But this is just, yeah.
I'm just curious whether you're going to talk about response functions.
Yeah,
I have the impression
well,
that the motivation for this definition is that the response function for phi
yeah.
have, you know, probability one
yeah, yeah.
for that whole region. And that
well, I mean, it's a little bit subtle, so I kind of wanted to avoid talking about it a bit because basically the response function for phi has to be equal to one on a measure zero set in on a measure one set according to mu phi. But it doesn't necessarily need to be quite this set, the set that that achieves the minimum here. So there is a sort of more subtle definition where you insist that these sets are also sets on which the response function is equal to one. But I'm just it's not going to end up mattering too much. So yeah, but that is one of the motivations. We can also look at the symmetric overlap. This maybe addresses Raphael's concern, which is the more naive thing, just sort of the area under these two graphs. And in the measure theoretic terms, that's given by this expression. So basically, you're looking for a set that is assigned the smallest possible probability by mu psi, and its complement is assigned a very small probability by mu phi. So again, this goes for if you have ontologically distinct states. Then there'll be a set that's measure one according to mu phi and measure zero according to mu psi. So this will be zero, and then it's the complement of a measure one set here is a measure zero set, so it'll be zero. And this varies between zero and one. And you can actually prove rigorously that if these things are represented by probability densities, then this is just the area under the graph here. But this has an operational interpretation, which is one of the reasons why it's useful to consider this measure, which is suppose somebody prepares psi or phi with probability half and you don't know which, and then they tell you what the ontic state is, then your probability of successfully determining which of these two was prepared is given by this expression, which you can see if the overlap is if the overlap is zero, you'll always succeed. And if the overlap is one, then you do know better than guessing, right? So that's the operational interpretation of this measure. Then this can also be compared to its sort of quantum equivalent, which is instead of having access to the ontic state, you have to make a quantum measurement to determine whether it was psi or phi that was prepared. Okay, so now we take the infimum instead of over measurable sets, we take the infimum over measurement operators, and we try to make this probability small and the probability of the opposite outcome on phi small. And this has the same interpretation, except now instead of being told the ontic state, you have to make a quantum measurement and try to determine whether it was psi or phi that was prepared. So those are kind of comparable measures, so we might want to look at their ratio. But really the point of all this is just that these things are very closely related. So of course, the symmetric overlap is less than the asymmetric overlap, and it's very easy to see from the sort of graph interpretation why that should be, right? We have a smaller area. The quantum overlap measures are also closely related. So this is the quantum symmetric overlap. And it's, this is just basically a standard result that comes from the representation of the trace distance in quantum information theory, that for pure states, this is given by this expression. And so therefore, if you just do a binomial expansion of this, you'll see that this symmetric overlap has to be larger than half the quantum probability. And hence, if we want to get a bound on the ratio of these kind of operationally motivated quantities, then if we can bound this ratio of the anti-symmetric overlap and the quantum probability, then within a factor of two, if I get an upper bound on this, I'll also get an upper bound on that. And since we're mostly interested in scaling with Hilbert space dimension, we don't have to worry too much about the constant factors. So that means that I can just look at bounding this quantity on the right here. Okay, so now overlap bounds. So I'm going to define this ratio of the anti-symmetric overlap to the quantum probability, which can, in principle, depend on the two states. Some previous results. First of all, Moroni was the first to show that a maximally epistemic interpretation is impossible. So this ratio has to be less than one for some states. And we subsequently showed that that has to follow from the Cauchy-Speicher theorem. And then more recently, John Barrett and co-authors showed that this ratio, there are some states for which this ratio must go like 1 over d. So it's tending to zero in large Hilbert space dimension. And today I want to show you a result which is sort of exponential. Well, in a large Hilbert space dimension, this term will be the dominant term. So in large Hilbert space dimensions, the amount of overlap compared to the quantum probability is getting smaller exponentially fast. And the C here is a positive constant, which I don't know what its value is at the moment. Okay. So in order to explain this result, I need the concept of an orthogonality graph. So basically, if you have a finite set of quantum states, I can draw a graph where the vertices are the quantum states themselves, and there's an edge between two vertices if and only if a pair of states is orthogonal. So I'm going to use this example here, which comes from the Klatchko proof of contextuality. So it's easy to understand what these states are sort of visually. So first of all, we're going to have five states in real three-dimensional Hilbert space. All these amplitudes here are real. And the way we can understand what these are is if you imagine taking the unit sphere and drawing a pentagram on the equator like this, then these states that are connected by a line, they have some angle between them, which is larger than the right angle. And if you take this pentagram and then just move it parallel to the equator up the side of the unit sphere, then what will happen is that the angle between these states and the origin will get smaller and smaller, and at some point it will hit 90 degrees. And when that happens, all of these states connected by a line will be orthogonal to one another, and these are the angles for which that happens. So the orthogonality graph of that is just a five cycle, right? So all I've done is redraw this in a different order. So the vertices are the states, and they're connected by an edge when they're orthogonal to one another. So the next concept I need is the independence number of a graph. So for any graph, the independence number is the cardinality of the largest subset of vertices, such that no two vertices in the set are connected by an edge. So, for example, in our five-cycle example, the independence number is two because, well, by symmetry, I can start by picking anyone I like. So let's pick this one. Then these two are connected by an edge, so they can't be in the set. And I've got to pick either this guy or this guy. And you can see that if I pick this guy, that one's ruled out, and vice versa. So the largest set has two vertices in it. So is that clear what that is? Some nodding. Okay, good. So now we can get to the main result. So suppose V is a finite set of states in Hilbert space dimension D, and G is its orthogonality graph. Then if we pick some other state in the Hilbert space and look at the average of this K ratio, so this is the average of the ratio of the asymmetric overlap to the quantum probability over this set of states, then in any ontological model, that has to satisfy this bound. So the independence number of the graph divided by the number of states in the set and the minimum quantum probability over all the states in that set. Okay, so I'm going to prove that to you in a minute. But first, I'll show you how you can use this to derive bounds. The other thing I want to mention, of course, is that since this is an average, that means that at least one of the states in this set, at least one of these A's, has a ratio that's as bad as the average. Okay. So although might not necessarily know which one it is, if I bound the average, then I know that there's some pair of states that has a ratio at least that bad. Okay, so this is just as an example. Here's how this can be used to derive bounds. So suppose you have these Klatchko states again, and now I'm going to choose my psi to be the two state. So that has inner product of cos theta with all of these guys, which is just 1 over the fourth root of 5. So now we can apply this bound. The independence number we saw was 2. There are 5 states in the set. And as it happens, all of these guys have the same inner product, 1 over the fourth root of 5, so that's also the minimum. And if you work that out, that gives you about 0.6. So that's enough to show you that the maximally psi epistemic is impossible. It's not actually the best known bound in three dimensions, but this is just to show you how this technique works out. Sorry? This is a real three-dimensional Hilbert space, so I just have a basis labeled. It's just some basis labeled 1, 2, and 3. Okay. It's the two bases. It's just the component that these guys all assign cos theta to. On this diagram, it's basically the state that's pointing up out of the pentagram like that. Okay, so where are we? Okay, so now this is how we get the exponential bound. So now basically want to consider what are called the Hadamard states. This is just the set of all states in D dimensions where the components are either plus or minus 1 up to normalization. So you can label these by bit strings, and the bit string determines whether each of the basis states gets a plus or minus 1. And then my state psi is going to just be the zero state. And now we can apply this bound again. So the first thing we need to know is what's the independence number of the orthogonality graph of these guys. And the orthogonality graph of these guys, they're known as Hadamard graphs in the literature. And there's a result in combinatorics from combinatorics, which allows us to provide a bound on these. So it's called the Franklin-Rödl theorem. Which says for D divisible by 4, these Hadamard graphs have there's a value, there's a positive number epsilon such that the independence number is less than 2 minus epsilon to the d. Okay, so that result just comes from a resulting classical combinatorics. So that's the independence number. Then we've got 2 to the d states, because I've got to choose a phase of plus or minus 1 for each basis vector. And again, all of the inner products here are 1 over d, so if I take the minimum, I get 1 over d here. And then if you just take logs and rearrange things, you'll see that this is d e to the minus cd, where this positive constant is given in terms of this epsilon here. This is a non-constructive result, so I don't know exactly what the value of this constant is, but obviously there will be some large Hilbert space dimension in which this term comes to dominate, and it'll start going down exponentially. Okay, so so that's the construction. So now the only thing I've got left to do is to convince you that this result holds true. So the bottom bit is easy, right? So I just got this cardinality of V comes from here. And remember, each of these is the ratio of the asymmetric overlap to the quantum probability. So if I just take the minimum of the denominators, right, and replace the denominator by the minimum of the denominator in each case, then that can only make the thing larger, right? So this minimum here is just pulling that factor out at the front. So all I have to show you is that the asymmetric overlaps, the sum of the asymmetric overlaps, is bounded by the independence number. Okay, so now we're getting into sort of the hairy technical bit, but it doesn't take too long, unfortunately. So first of all, I need a covering set of bases, right? So I have this set of states, and they have certain orthogonality relations in them. So if A is orthogonal to B, then that means that there's some basis in the Hilbert space that includes both A and B. And by a covering set, I mean a set of bases such that every time I've got an orthogonality here, there's some basis in the set which includes those two states. That set can be taken to be finite, because we assume that V was finite. So M is a finite set of bases. Then for each basis in this set, I can define the set of ontic states that always yield the outcome A with certainty in this basis measurement, right? So this is just some set of states. I'm not demanding that my model necessarily is deterministic or anything, but in any model, there may be some set of states which assign probability 1 to the outcome A in that basis measurement. Now, this set has to be measure 1 according to mu A, the probability measure associated with A, because we have to reproduce this quantum prediction that when you prepare the state A and measure a basis that includes A, I always get the outcome A. So if you were to integrate this probability density without the response function here, you get 1. So in order to preserve that 1, this thing must be equal to 1 on a set that's measure 1 according to mu A. Okay, so these sets are measure 1. So now what I can do is take the intersection of all of those sets. So A might, because we're in a contextual model, potentially a contextual model, A may appear in more than one basis, and the set of states that give me that outcome might be different for different bases. So I'm just going to take the intersection of those over all of the bases that contain A. So this is the set of ontic states that always give me the outcome A, regardless of which basis it's measured in. This also has to be a measure 1 set, because, as I said, M can be finite. And what we're doing is we're taking the intersection of measure 1 sets, a finite number of measure 1 sets. So by countable additivity, that means that that's also a measure 1 set. So hence, remember our definition of the asymmetric overlap was the infimum over all measure 1 sets, according to mu A here. So if I take any particular set that's measure 1, that must be an upper bound on that. Okay, and now, so this is what I just proved. And now if we just take the sum over all of the states in our set, then we'll get that bound. And now what I want to do is introduce the indicator function onto these sets. So these are the sets that always give the outcome A regardless of the basis. So try A is equal to 1 if I'm in that set and 0 otherwise. And that's just allowed me to write the right-hand side, rewrite the right-hand side here in this terms. So what I can do is replace these by integrals over the indicator functions. And then once I do that, because I have the same measure on each term, I can pull out the measure and just have the sum of the indicator functions in the middle. And now by convexity, basically this is just a convex combination of this combination of indicator functions for different values of lambda. So by convexity, this must be less than the maximum or supremum over all possible lambdas of this sum of indicator functions. So for any given lambda, what this term tells me is how many of these sets can I be in at the same time, right? That's what this sum of indicator functions is. It's the number of sets that lambda is in. So this is going to be bounded by the largest possible number of these different sets that any lambda can be in. But that's going to be bounded by the independence number for the following reason. So if I have two orthogonal states, then these sets, well, then there's a basis that contains both of them, right? That's M. And those sets must then be disjoint because the indicator functions must sum to 1 over the complete basis. So there may be other states in the bases, but if I sum these two, it's got to be less than or equal to 1. And so if one of these is equal to 1, then the other one's equal to 0 and vice versa. So these sets, which are the sets on which they're equal to 1, must be disjoint. But that also means that when I take the intersection of all of the bases which these appear, they're also disjoint because these two guys are just subsets of these two guys. They come from forming an intersection. So those are also disjoint. So what that means is if you have a lambda that's in one of these, then it can't be in the other one if these two are orthogonal. So in graph theory terms, if there's an edge between those two vertices in the orthogonality graphs, then you can only be in at most one of those sets you can be in at most. So that means that what you're basically doing is you're picking the vertices of the orthogonality graph, and you can't have two vertices which are connected by an edge. And that was the definition of the independence number. So hence this thing is bounded by the independence number, which was the result that we needed. Okay, so is there any questions about that before we? Okay. So this, especially those of you who are familiar with the literature on contextuality inequalities will note that the independence number also crops up there as a bound on contextuality inequalities. And that's not an accident. These two things are closely connected. So to explain that, in terms of this particular framework, what it means for an ontological model for some finite set of bases to be quotient spec and non-contextual is the combination of two things. Firstly, the model must be outcome deterministic, which means that every ontic state assigns every basis a unique 0 or 1 probability to every basis element. And it must be measurement non-contextual, which means that if the same state appears in more than one basis, then it gets the same value, so it gets the same indicator function. That's what quotient spec and non-contextuality looks like in this framework. And it's very easy to see that if a model is quotient spec and non-contextual, then it must satisfy this constraint. So previously, I was looking at this term in the general case as an upper bound on the asymmetric overlap. But if the model is non-contextual, it must actually be the total quantum probability. It must be the total probability assigned to that outcome. And the reason for that is, well, first of all, because of this, it doesn't really matter if I use the curly M or the non-curly M here, because the indicator functions are all the same, so they have the same set of states that give you the value 1. And then these are all either 0 or 1, so I only need to integrate here over the set on which it's equal to 1, which is just gamma A of M. Right, so in a non-contextual model, The total probability is the thing that I was using as the upper bound. So that means that any time you've got a bound on the amount on the probability that can be assigned to something in a non-contextual model, there is actually, by the way, a converse to this theorem as well, up to some measure theoretic technicalities. So that means that any time I've got a bound on the probabilities that can occur in a non-contextual model, I also, in the more general case of a possibly contextual model, have a bound on the asymmetric overlap. So any Cauchy-Specker contextuality inequality will give you a bound on the overlap. So there may be, so this is the best one, the exponential one is the best one that I found that I show you, but you can look through all of the contextuality inequalities to find other examples. Okay, so to finish up, first of all, to summarize, we've shown that there exist pairs of states such that the ratio of overlaps must go like this. So that's going to look exponential in sufficiently large Hilbert space dimension. So the psi epistemic explanations of these phenomena are going to get implausible very rapidly when you have large Hilbert space dimension. And any contextuality inequality can be used to provide a bound. So some open questions. I haven't at the moment done any error analysis on this. So if you wanted to somehow prove this experimentally, then you would need to see what happens if you don't get things exactly correct. Similarly, for the purposes of experiments, it'll be good to look for the best bounds in small dimensions, because you're probably not going to do an experiment with you know, a huge dimensional Hilbert space. The other thing which is kind of important, well, very important, I'd say, is if you go back to the construction that I had, let's see, with the Hadamard states, you can see that this state here and these states here, their inner product also goes down with Hilbert space dimension. It's 1 over d. So what you've really shown is that this ratio is, so the amount of overlap is a tiny fraction of a probability that's already tiny. So that means that, you know, there's certainly sets of states for which the epistemic explanation of their distinguishability doesn't work. You know, you could certainly imagine a theory in which the psi epistemic explanation works very well for things which have a large overlap and then somehow gets worse. So the question is really, if we fix the inner product and increase the Hilbert space dimension, must things still get exponentially worse? There's a connection between these results and communication complexity, which I've been discussing with Alberto and Montina. You can use these kind of results to derive communication complexity results, but the current versions that I've got don't actually give you anything new beyond what we already know. But it's possible that by looking at other contextuality inequalities, we may get some new results there. So just to finish off, well, I've explained that, you know, the case isn't quite 100% watertight yet because we have this fixed inner product problem. But it certainly looks to me like we're deriving more and more bounds, and that this psi epistemic explanation within the ontological models framework is going to get more and more constrained. So what should you do if that happens and you want to still be a psi epistemicist? You always have the option of becoming some kind of neo-Copenhagen interpretation. Those kinds of interpretations have the problems that people normally talk about. I'm not personally a big fan, but that's a separate discussion. If you want to maintain realism, then of course you can adopt many of these options that don't fit into the ontological models framework. So something employing a non-standard logic or probability theory. But one has to be a bit careful here, because often those kinds of theory are given operational interpretations. So if you really want to be realist about it, then you've got to be very careful about what it means to say that logic is different really, or what kind of realist theory can support that. There's something that I call the ironic many worlds option, because obviously a many worlds ontology isn't included in the ontological models framework, but the usual motivation for adopting the many worlds theory is to take the description of to take the quantum formalism as a literal description of reality. So it means that part of the motivation for that is viewing the wave function as a literal description of reality. So if you don't do that, then the motivation for considering many worlds is a bit, you know, opaque. But nevertheless, the possibility is open that there might be a theory that employs a many worlds ontology in which the wave function is epistemic, certainly not being ruled out. And there are other options which people discuss as well. So my own personal view is that the answer lies somewhere here. And the reason why I think that is because I'm trying to sort of formulate a principle for why I think that. And it would have to be something like a principle of minimizing weirdness. So the idea is, okay, we know quantum mechanics is weird and counterintuitive, but I think that an interpretation of quantum mechanics shouldn't be more weird than it has to be. So the idea here is that if you have a very natural explanation for a class of phenomena, such as the psi epistemic explanations, then you ought to be looking for a interpretation in which those explanations are true, and you shouldn't make things that aren't weird, that we have good explanations for, into weird things, which happens if you have a real wave function. So what I'm suggesting is that what we're really looking for is a subtle but radical change of ontology, which makes the things that make sense still make sense, but doesn't introduce any more counterintuitive features than are actually necessary. Okay, so that's roughly all I wanted to say. And the reference is, this review article is coming out very shortly, I hope. The connection to contextuality was first discussed in a paper with Owen Maroney, and this exponential overlap bound, which I described, is in this paper. So thanks for your attention.
I think this result is interesting and valuable, but as an epistemicist who didn't make it onto your list with Einstein and Valentine,
yeah, sorry about that.
I think the way you're presenting it is highly misleading. It's very natural in an epistemic view to have, in fact, required to have the measurements are represented by response functions which have support on sets of measure that are not measure zero, and so essentially your measurement functions are coarse-grained or fuzzy. And so there's, in fact, no a priori reason to assume that the indistinguishability of states that are almost perfectly distinguishable should be entirely explained just by considering the overlap of the states. It's, in fact, I would have expected this in an epistemic view, that the fuzziness of the measurement functions would make up for some contribution to the indistinguishability of states. And you know what the right ratio should be, there's really no a priori argument to expect that, you know, 10% or 90%
sure.
of the overlap should or shouldn't be explained by just considering the overlap of the states.
So, I mean, I more or less agree with that, but note the following. So first of all, if these overlap measures are actually zero, then you have a psiontic theory, okay? So whilst I agree that it's not clear that the maximally epistemic definition, for instance, is the right one, so why not just 50% of the probability described in that way? I would suggest that if you have a result which is like tending to zero, then you have a problem.
But it's tending to zero for states which the distinguishability is tending to zero or one, whichever one it is.
The yeah, that's true.
Distinguishability is tending to
that,
zero.
That is true in the current constructions. So you can at least say for those sets of states, the explanation doesn't work very well, but. Obviously, that's not all states. That's why, you know, as pointed out, this important open question about the states that we've fixed in a product. But I think it's going to turn out, like, personally, I think it's going to turn out. I don't see any reason why we won't get bounds for those that go to zero. Whether it goes to zero exponentially, I don't know. But I think any time it goes to zero, you're going to have a problem with large Hilbert space dimension.
But I mean, I'm surprised that you present, I mean, your conclusion and introduction really present this as some kind of implication that psi epistemics has a problem. And I mean, I don't see any problem from this. As long as the overlap has finite measure, then you're still happily saying that the states are epistemic.
Well, even if the overlap is like some tiny epsilon bounded away from zero, then you're happy to call that psi epistemic. Is that your position?
Well, I mean, that's a world in which the physical states, the quantum states, are not physical. They're undetermined by the physical state. So why wouldn't it be?
Well, I mean, but they're determined. They may be determined with very high probability. I mean, I agree with you in the following sense. One should regard this kind of result as a stepping stone. I mean, first of all, we know that we can't rule out the most permissive definition of psi epistemic because of the existence of these Cauchy-Speicher model and these other models. So the questions that we're trying to investigate here is, what are stronger notions of psi epistemicity that may still be ruled out? Now, I agree that this kind of result is a stepping stone towards perhaps, you know, ruling out some slightly weaker notions, even weaker than what I've talked about here, of psi epistemicity. Now, one thing I didn't mention is that and one can make an assumption about these models, which is a kind of continuity assumption, which Barrett and co-authors do make, which is that there should exist a K let me go back to it. I didn't want to make that assumption because I don't think it's very natural. I know you can't see this really now. But if we go back to the definition of K.
But what's the upshot of this continuity assumption?
The upshot would be that it basically says that there should exist a K such that for all states, K is larger than some fixed K for any Hilbert space dimension. So that would make K a parameter which doesn't depend on the pair of states you're looking at. So they actually do make that simplifying assumption, and hence their conclusion is a bit stronger. So if you do consider that class of models, and it is a type of continuity assumption, mathematicians call it Lipschitz continuity, and you may regard that as a reasonable assumption or not. Personally, I don't see any reason why this can't depend at least on the inner product between the two states. If I make an additional assumption, I can get a stronger conclusion, obviously. But, you know, I've been trying to avoid making additional assumptions here.
Cool. So first of all, plus one on Joe's comment. I'm wondering if you can find a bound on your asymmetric overlap in a slightly different way, using probabilities for unambiguous discrimination.
Yeah, well, so you can certainly, let's see. I mean, so there's certainly this idea that if you have what I call an anti-distinguishable set of states, so like used in the original proof of the PBR theorem. So if I have, say, three states, and there's a POVM with an element that's orthogonal to each one of the states in the set, then I'll be able to show that the three-way overlaps are zero using that. But I haven't, without additional assumptions, I haven't been able to see how to wrangle that into, it's certainly not obvious how to wrangle that into two-way overlap, results about two-way overlaps.
A more general comment would be if you want to overcome the sort of objection that says, well, you know, nothing in the psi epistemic viewpoint dictated that all of the operational indistinguishability of two states should be due to their ontological overlap. Some of it could be due to the fuzziness of the response functions. In unambiguous discrimination, typically you can't use fuzzy response functions to explain that. If I had, you know, non-zero response everywhere, that would tend to eliminate the possibility of unambiguous discrimination
right.
state. So it seems like a more natural, so, you know, move from correct classification to unambiguous discrimination. That seems like the right direction to go to overcome these sorts of objections.
But I believe, didn't you tell me a while ago that difference between unambiguous and minimum error discrimination could be turned into a proof of contextuality? Didn't you say that
a
while ago? So I think it's probably, the connection to this probably goes via that connection, I would have thought. It's probably worth looking at. But I would need to see the way that proof works again.
Matt, how does relationalism come to the aid of the psi?
Oh, well, I mean, it's just the idea here is that in the ontological models framework, we assume that there's some ontic state space, which is a set of intrinsic properties of the system. So if you say that there are no such properties, all properties are about the relation of one system to another system, then that doesn't fit into the framework. Now, whether you can write down a model that gets around these results, I know I'm not the world's biggest advocate of that particular approach, but I put it in because Rob is always going on about it.
To what?
So that bound for k bar that you showed,
yeah,
which had the independence number in the numerator, it looked like it had something like the Lorentz number in the denominator. Is it actually the Lorentz number?
So again, this is a difference between what I did and what Barrett and company did. So if you take, so you can define either the average of the ratios or the ratio of the averages. So if I defined the average overlap divided by the average quantum probability, then I would get the Lovats number on the bottom. As it happens in the proofs, it is the Lovats number because I've had constructions where all the inner products are equal, so that doesn't make any difference there. But if you want to, you know, so if you want to get the Lovats number down there, you'd have to define the ratio of averages rather than the average of ratios. But I think for some reason, to me, it seems to make more sense. Well, the thing we want to look at is the ratio. So I want to look at the average of those ratios so that I can infer that there's at least one pair of states for which it's at least as bad as that. And I can't do it if I do the other way around.
So that expression that you wrote down is a kind of a different graph invariant when you optimize the repsi?
I don't actually know if it's a graph invariant. I haven't found anything that's like that. I mean, it's like you're trying to find a state that's sort of as close to all of the states as, you know, because you're trading off the closeness with one with the closeness of another. Because you don't look at the minimum inner product, so you're going to try and maintain a high inner product with all of the states. So it's definitely a different optimization problem.
I'm not quite sure at the moment, but I might be remembering something like, so if you take the optimal of a normal representation, which actually gives it a Lorentz number, then all the inner products are equal. So in that case, you would...
Okay, well, if that's the case, then maybe it is the same, which would be nice.
Yeah, I'll have to look though.
Yeah.
Do you have an idea if you took two states at random, how bad this ratio would be? Are these counterexamples, are they very rare, or are they common?
That's interesting. So random quantum states would have an overlap of 1 over d, which is similar to your Hadamard states.
Yeah, but so, I mean, all of these proofs involve families of states and not just a pair. I mean, I don't know. So I think the first question to figure out is how these ratios must depend on the inner product. Because I think it's very reasonable to assume that k only depends on the inner product of the states. Because in particular, the constructions we normally use to prove these things would be rotationally invariant, right? So, at least in these particular constructions, all the inner products were equal anyway. So certainly, if it turns out that we get the best bounds from those sorts of constructions, then it's quite natural to assume that that they only depend on the inner product. And then if you had that, you could answer that question by saying, okay, let's take two states at random, what's the most likely inner product? And then you could answer it that way. But right now, I don't know. I mean, I don't have a construction of a random set. I don't think it's the case. Well, I'm pretty sure that it's the case that if you took a random set of states, they wouldn't form a contextuality proof, for instance. So so you wouldn't be able to use this type of proof to provide a bound for those.
Yeah, or you could ask, given the inner product, take two at random, what would, I mean, as you pointed out, it's more interesting for a large inner product.
Well, it's more interesting to see what it's like as a function of the inner product, I'd say. Because, you know, who says when the psi epistemic explanation needs to kick in? You know, for what inner product should it kick in? It's certainly interesting to look at it as a function of the inner product, I'd say.
So also a general question about what's meant by this approach that's being, it's not disproven, but some evidence is being provided against it. I don't know if I can make a sharp question, but is it in some sense an assumption of this point of view that measurements just reveal what's there already and don't?
Well, no, because you can
not say that?
You could have genuine stochasticity. Remember, the response functions aren't necessarily determined.
I mean, they might reveal a probabilistic, but it might be in this part screening or whatever you're talking about.
Yeah, so, but I mean, this framework can, for example, this framework does include the theory in which the wave function and only the wave function is the physical state of the system, right. And you have genuine stochasticity, you know, the measurements are genuinely probabilistic. So it's not, it's certainly not saying determinism. Yeah, it's more than just coarse graining. It's also that we're allowing the measurements to be probabilistic.
There's something I can't put my finger on, as I said. It's like there's some notion that there's some underlying feeling, I think, that there's some such notion as state at a given time. And the measurement is revealing some aspect of that, maybe with more greater or lesser fidelity.
Well, yeah, I mean, there certainly is. I mean, here we're only considering a very simple setup where you have a prepare and measure experiment, so it's quite simple. But certainly, if you incorporated dynamics into this framework, you would talk about ontic state at a given time. So it is that kind of framework. It kind of assumes, and that's why I mentioned retrocausality, right? Or more generally, a kind of block universe type of approach could get around this kind of constraint.
Yeah, or what I was calling history, I think sort of fits into
it. It depends on the
it's not just a sequence of states.
Yeah. So I mean, I don't think a historist formalism says one way or the other, but interpretations which are based on histories. Different ones, different versions of it would come down on different sides as to whether it falls into this framework or not.
Right.
So, you know, history is formalism equipped with some type of history's interpretation.
Yeah,
may or may not. Yeah, sure.
I mean, something where you take the reality to be something more in the nature of history.
Sure. I mean, so just saying that doesn't get you out of this framework, but the rules by how, you know, the actual histories or sets of histories are determined, they either will or won't fall into this framework, depending on how you choose to set that up.
Yeah, I was thinking of something like what you advocated in the end, but based very much on this space-time notion of reality.
Sure.
Any more questions? Okay, thanks, man.
Thanks.